Okay, thank you. Pat?
Just wondered what were the numbers of women members in the party at the time?
I don't know.
Just that curiosity, how they've grown along, obviously the minority there became the response to the struggle at the time.
I don't know what. I mean, there were women who were at the formation of the party, but I don't know how many. That was one of these questions that I had written down for myself to find out, but I haven't found out.
Probably the same as today, about 10%.
Yeah. Mm. We haven't mainly tried to understand why that is, why it was supposed to be in the man, and then maybe sort of axiomatic being in a man's world that there's all men seem to be their character, or whether being their gender, and in their role in the work and industry, that might be the case.
Any thoughts on that, Pat?
Well, it's not a question that I can actually answer. I did, at some time, I asked a comrade Hardy what had been the position of women in the SDF, and I had this nice little handwritten reply from him that the SDF programmes. The object included the establishment of social and economic equality between the sexes, and their programmes included the demand for equal direct adult suffrage for women and for men. The SDF and the Fabian Society signed the 1890 Manifesto of English Socialists. The manifesto included equal payment of men and women for equal work, which is interesting. Universal suffrage for all adults, men and women alike, and the free maintenance of all necessitous children, which, as you may recall, was one of the things that led the members to break away. But at some time, I had the opportunity to look in some minute books of the SDF, and there it was interesting to see what the women were involved with. They were involved with sort of organising social events and things, which isn't necessarily a bad thing if you bring to an organisation whatever you can do, and hopefully when you get into it, then you expand to do other things. But I mean, the politics was something for men. I mean, my father had the same view, really, that when a man came home from work, which also sets the within the sort of context of the times, doesn't want to be, wants to have things discussing other, doesn't want to be discussing the outside, wants to get away from it. It's a different sort of thing. But I mean, that's the number of women MPs, it's gone up now, it's about 140 something out of 650. But it hasn't, although there are individual cases of women who haven't been able to get on shortlists and so on, there hasn't been in that extraordinary number of women trying to do it in the past. So if there had been, then more would have got into it. But as the example at Hull at the university, if it's all men doing the selecting, then they're quite likely to choose men. But I mean, I don't have a specific answer to why it should be.
Well, I was wondering, in relation to women's suffrage, I mean, say we had a party in Switzerland, if they only got women's suffrage about 30 years ago, something like that, probably a bit more. I mean, do you think a party there would have gone along with the attitude of a party in the 1900s? And also in relation to that, if there was a dominant personality like Rosa Luxemburg in the party, would she have gone along with it? I suspect she wouldn't have done.
No.
I mean, the idea that there's enough votes, broadly speaking, I mean, there was all these statements that were a little bit more involved than the traditional view, but the traditional view, the simplistic view, there's enough votes in the working class to bring about socialism. and it was almost patronising, you know, the women don't have to do it because there's enough votes already for socialist majority. I think it's a patronising view. I mean, it's probably a product of that era. But I don't think a socialist party can get away with it nowadays.
Don't you listen to what Pat was saying, but she'd explain that.
Yeah. Well, there's part of that, but this is what Rosa Luxemburg said, that she wasn't interested in high principled campaigns for women's rights. She considered the inferior status of women a social feature which would be eliminated only by the advent of socialism. That's on that. On that specific thing. I mean, the situation would be the same. The difficulty was getting support for socialism, and if you're in a place where, as we were, where so the ideas that you needed to was the consciousness of the nature of the system and how to move forward, not to whilst we consider the vote to be very important. If you've got the growing sort of consciousness, the growing movement of socialists, then you jolly well get the franchise. Incidentally, the vote was extended to 18-year-olds without any great campaigns or any campaigns. As I can remember someone talking about an inquiry into it, but without any great campaigns about it. I mean, I think that the view would be that you would be working to put forward socialist ideas. You would also be within that, because it's a democratic aim and you need the democratic means within that, you would be working to get the vote, but not as a separate thing and not allied with people who are wanting it for their own purposes.
I'd have thought if there was a referendum like in Switzerland, obviously, socialists are going to vote for extend the franchise. Even in Ireland, when they had a referendum to permit divorce, party members there voted for it. I mean, what's the big problem?
Oh, yes, it's a question of just the voting, right?
Anybody else want to say anything?
There's something that we wouldn't use the same language today as they used at the time. I mean, the photocopy of the article that with the letter from Mrs. Pethick Lawrence in. But there's another nice one that I didn't use in the meeting that is headed. It's a report of a debate that took place, and it's headed "Suffragette Mangled." Well, I mean, we wouldn't actually say that today. But the woman got off to a bad foot because she wanted the title of the question to be changed, which and it says, "Ye gallant gentleman Anderson, you know, agreed to the change." Then she didn't want to speak first, so he spoke first, and he did so well, you know, that the audience were with him. And it goes on to say, "The poor girl did her best." Well, I mean, we simply wouldn't say that now. But of course, that kind of language, I mean, it wasn't singled out for women. Opposition, there was a very robust attitude to opposition and how it was voiced. But as I say, you know, it's the language of the times that.
I think there's probably a kind of no one seems to have raised it yet, but I mean, possibly we've been talking about formal women's equality here, you know, in a legally defined sense. But I think it's fairly self-evident that women's position in society has changed because of the various social changes that have gone on in the last 150 years. And as Pat rightly, you know, pointed out, Marx, you know, alluded to this, as capitalism develops as a mode of production, you know, so gender roles and, you know, family structures will change. So I'm trying to think where I'm going with this. Again, I mean, I think as long as we're talking about, say, the First World War and things like that, I mean, the way I always look at it is, what was people's position towards the war. For example, you know, what stance did they take? You know, Rosa Luxemburg took an international stance. You know, Alexandra Kollontai, although obviously subsequently ranked it under Bolshevik, was an internationalist and opposed the war. You know, you hit the nail on the head. A lot of the bourgeois feminists in all the European countries actually got straight on the war effort. I guess the only exception I can really think of is Sylvia Pankhurst, you know, in this country. I mean, I just looking back, I mean, it always strikes me, you know, how far advanced that is towards women was in organisations like the SDF and, you know, the SPGB. You know, I don't think there's any question about it because, you know, before there was a full legalised, you know, right to vote for women, women could join and participate in the SPGB you know, as equals. Now, obviously, I mean, I've only really read Bartol's book on it and I don't know what kind of concrete research there is as to, you know, who did what within the party. And I'm struggling to remember the name of the woman as General Secretary during the First World War, for example. So, I mean, yeah, that would be one aspect of it. I think just in a wider sense, I think... as capitalism's developing, you know, as we've been saying, we do see changes in family structures and gender roles. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, untapped labour potential there. That's why women are being, you know, kind of brought into the labour market in a much more formal and direct sense. And, you know, as you said, that, you know, that's been going on, you know, since the Second World War. And you know, for all, I mean, all the horrors of war, you could say the war at least finally demonstrate the idea, you know, put light to the idea that women can't, you know, work on the same equal kind of basis. Man, I know it's a terrible, you know, the circumstances in which it comes about are absolutely terrible, but you know, it gave direct light, you know, in people's everyday experience that you know, women somehow couldn't do the same jobs as men or whatever. I mean, and lastly, I think, I'm getting horribly anecdotal and I can't really pull out any...
We've got plenty of time, nobody else wants to say anything.
Well, thanks, Ed. So I'd say in the modern kind of work patterns and whatever, women can find themselves doubly oppressed because they've got to work full-time jobs, they're under pressure to have careers, but also, you know, they will have to still do the majority of housework and child-rearing, despite, you know, the fact that we're all supposed to be kind of, you know, I'm sort of males and whatever, at least they don't. I mean, I don't know, you know, what he was causing on that.
Yeah, another woman was Charlotte Despard, who was opposed to the war and I think courageously spoke out at a public meeting. I mean, there's a photograph of her, I think it was in Victoria Park, but, you know, addressing a great crowd of men in opposition to the war. I mean, this was a courageous... And as you said, Sylvia Pankhurst as well, you know, opposed the war, but the others didn't. There was something else you said that I was going to comment on. But
there was a woman in General Secretary during the First World War.
Yes, but no, I don't know that she was the one who had the numbers member in a bag. Yes, so they didn't think a woman would have them. Yes. Members' names.
Charlotte Despard spoke at Victoria Park.
Yes.
Member.
No, a suffragette.
Oh, suffragette. Like
opposing the First World War. I mean, women in the party have played the role that they want to play. The question is, well, I don't think it. I would be concerned about the number of women in the party if there were thousands of men and only, you know, sort of the same number of women. But, I mean, the problem is of people, you know, of men and women to time to work in the party.
In the end, sort of women's equality isn't incompatible with capitalism. I mean, you know, the feminists in the 1960s tried to argue that feminism was naturally anti-capitalist, but capitalism, well, I mean, like, probably will in the end achieve equality between men and women, you know, formal equality, equal wage slaves, I think is the phrase. That's, I mean, that feminist idea, or the radical feminist idea, or, well, that's a different thing, that's a left-wing feminist idea. Well, culturally wrong, isn't it? But most feminists today just want to become at least one women, some women to become generals and company directors and equal members of the elite.
Yeah, there's you say about the equality now, there's the Department for Work and Pensions publication. It has the equality impact assessments, and you've got all these several steps. It involves assessing the effects of policies or services, redisability, gender, racial equality. Step one is a short exercise that involves looking at the overall policy or service and deciding if it is relevant to equality. Step two examines the proposal in detail, which groups will affect and how much is irrelevant to equality. And there are 8 steps in this process, but I got bored after the second one and didn't take on that. And there was something else about the I was looking at sort of feminist activities now, and I'll find it. Oh, the thing, I think it was called a slut march.
Oh, yes.
And there was one, I think, in New York, and there was one in this country. But really, sort of on the thing that women ought to be allowed to dress just as they like, you know, regardless. And it's a men's problem if that has some effect on them. But it doesn't really seem very sensible to some of the things to me. I mean, you'd like to be able to go out and not lock your front door or your doors and things, but you can't do it. But I was thinking of the other kind of discrimination too, that sometimes said, well, you know, why weren't there more women artists, you know, painters and so on? But in the 19th century, women were not allowed to join things like the Royal Academy, and if you couldn't get in, if you couldn't get into the academy, you were restricted and where how you could show your art and so on. And I mean, there were a lot of different things like that they weren't allowed to get into. They might one day be able to be bishops, I guess.
They are bishops in some churches.
Yes.
Sorry.
I just think governments have changeable views on women working, don't they?
Oh, yes.
I mean, the position of, you referred to the war when women were called up for services and also for what they call it, war work. My sister worked in a munitions factory, attractive labour for men and for women. But then after the war, women were very much encouraged to get back into the home and put their pinnies on and get cooking and, you know, using what small labour-saving devices were coming into being. And now they've got everybody to get back to work, and they're urging them. And there aren't the jobs of that.
No.
And this new government initiative we heard of, I think, yesterday, where, or is it the Labour Party are going to, if they get into office, they spend zillions on putting people into jobs for at least 6 months. And where are they creating them from? I really don't know. They must have a magic wand somewhere.
You feel these things really ought to have, I mean, this sort of question of finding jobs, sort of looking at things the wrong way round, instead of, as we would, looking at, well, what's the work that needs doing? How many people does it need to do it? And looking at it from that way round, and you'd think that as a sort of thinking, reasoning beings, that really should sort of strike home to more people, to look at it like that, and this sort of begging for more things to be made, to be sold in competition with other people, people sort of selling the same things, instead of, I say, look, what do we need? How many people do we need? What materials do we need for it? And looking at it from that way round.
Can I just say something from my perspective as a teacher? The amount of children, little children, and I'm talking about 4-year-olds that come into school and go to breakfast club,
yeah,
go to school all day, and then go to after school club.
Mm.
What has equality done to the future children, you know, the future society members? And you can pick out the children who are nurtured in what I would call an old-fashioned way, and those who actually have to fend for themselves and have to quite often bring themselves up because the parents go to work, or the sole parent, who is the sole carer, has to go to work, and some of the pressures that these children are under is phenomenal. To say nothing of, you know, I can think of teachers who have got very young families and the pressure that they are under to perform at work. And contrary to most people's belief that teachers, you know, go into work at 9 o'clock and then leave at 3 o'clock, the pressure that these young teachers are under to try and keep their young families at home, I just can't understand what society is really doing. You know, where is equality? You know, I've seen for myself, I was the housewife, I've had the scathing remarks from other people who were career women, and then I gradually took on more and more, and, you know, my initial reward was, well, you do your job and you do everything else as well and fit it all in. You know, that for me was how equality worked, and I wonder what society is really doing to people when they talk about equality of women and, you know, what is happening to the children.
Could I add to that? Hopefully, because I've been sitting here for the last, since you started, this was my first thought. I used to work in after school play centres, and like this speaker has just said, Heather, children would come in, these would be from 5 years of age to 12, and then I'd do youth club, the 12 year old part time work with my own child, of course, who I'd be dragging around with me. But they'd come in with the key round their neck. Like you say, you can spot the mama. A few of them from the, I don't want to put it like this, but it's the truth. Vauxhall, they would be shoved outside of the crappiest play centre going. It was just an open pit, you know, outside in all weathers, freezing cold, while the schools kept warm, Vauxhall School, but you were not allowed in there. I used to have absolute rows with the school and the keep about it to let children inside, because this was a multicultural school. Children were coming from every part of Africa, India, all over the world. We had, I think it was 136 languages at the time, and I'm going back to the 90s, early 90s. And I can remember a father once walked in, this is anecdotal as well, but his children were in sopping wet clothes. A single parent had tried to wash the clothes the night before, they were wet, put them on the child, so it was more like a bit like here sometimes, where you're trying to sort out people's problems, even though that's not what we're for, sort of thing. But they were all hanging around on the radiators and everything else. But the question is, the relationships, the amount of rows, the amount of aggravation, even the other workers who were working with me, struggling to keep their own children while looking after other people's children, it was just a complete breakdown of relationships in a way. While in between you could watch this coercive state doing its work. You'd have the TV man, Christmas Eve, going around the blocks of flats catching the mums who haven't got the TV licence, and you'd hear that he's charged £900 fine for not having a television licence. Just everything being, you know, like you said, some get it more than others in the class, and you're right. You'd see it all the time. The poorer, the more you're beaten. It was terrible. But the relationship, see, like you say, how does it help us, all this dragging us out to work? Some mothers like to be with children. Some mothers are not that impressed with all the childcare and everything. Fathers do it better, etc., etc. But that's why I'm here, about relationships, you know, because they've been absolute horrible the ones I've seen.
Yes, I did when I was getting this ready. I sort of thought I was reminding myself about the sort of generation thing, and the view of what has happened with that Heather sort of put very well. what has happened to children and what that has to do with equality. And I thought, well, I have to be careful because I, you know, obviously sort of feel more critical of what has happened to young children, going at earlier and earlier time to nurseries, and just what that has to do with the, some kind of freedom and equality. It doesn't mean that you sort of think that a woman shouldn't do anything else. And it doesn't mean that I didn't think it was very nice when someone came and like Evelyn, and to give a hand, or someone that, you know, the children were taken out and you got a breather. That's not a contradiction to say that, you know, it seems a good idea for mothers, which doesn't preclude fathers, but... that was part of this sort of rejection of the woman's sort of biological role was something else, an element in the women's movement, and the idea that it was all conditioning, the sort of feminine behaviour and masculine behaviour, and you had some of these women who tried to bring up their little boys as though they were little girls, as it were, to make sure that they grew up to be, you know, nice, kind men and not the usual kind of man that they thought of. But, that was on that.
I think right here what we're talking about, maybe the last couple of speakers have been alluding to, is a massive contradiction of capitalism. Right there, it needs to free people up more for work. But as we see it, you know, we're seeing breakdowns in you know, human relations as a consequence of that. Yeah, I mean, it's an unbelievably trite about it. It's yet another example where we need to end capitalist relations, so we can begin to emancipate ourselves and, you know, live on a rational basis in all our interests. We're rolling in the interests of capital. I'd be interested to sort of see what, you know, ideas people may think, you know, you'd have for such child rearing in a post-capitalist society. I'm always bang on about this, but I think the Israeli kibbutz movement points the way forward in this, you know, collective child rearing within communities, you know. And I mean, I don't mean sending, like they try to begin in the kibbutz movement, where they just take kids away from their parents in the dormitories. But, you know, if you're living in a community where you know you can, your child will be raised and looked after, you know, it frees you up to go and do other things. You know, and they are looked after collectively by the community all day. You know, you could rotate that work whilst people go off and do other kinds of work, and, you know, you still get to spend time with your kids or whatever. I mean, you know, that seems to me to be an ideal. But, I mean, you know, we're even seeing at the moment the amount of extra outlay people have to spend on childcare. You know, and that's now a major part of, you know, your outlay, considering whether you can work. Now, a lot of state nurseries don't open until 9 o'clock, which for most people, you know, that's not good. You know, people have got to be up and out and at work long before that. So, yeah, you know, it seems to me it's yet another kind of illustration of the contradictions that capitalism, you know, it gives us.
You're opposed to collective child rearing?
I wouldn't want to impose my views. It's up to people's choice. I mean, surely some sort of a mixture. And I know Danny sort of reduces the amount of work that would be necessary to a much lower level than I think I would care to go along with. I mean, I think he thinks that, you know, 2 days would be enough, but... I don't agree with that from another point of view, because I think work is a necessary part of our being. I mean, human beings need to be creative, need to be, you know, sort of doing things, so that, that wouldn't be kind to say that we could only work maybe a day or so. But, I mean, one of the other things that's happened with children is this very much... the acquisition of sort of things and the things that cost money and the what's in view. It's not just sort of looking in the toy shop window. there's much more putting in front of what is available, what costs money, and children, small children, are very, very sort of money conscious and of things that they want. And one thing that's, the important word for young children to learn, I think, is the no word, and that seems not necessarily to be there, but that's a personal viewpoint. But I don't know about. I think there's a sort of a natural role for a woman is the child core, and when my children were small, I sort of felt what I sort of felt as a physical need to be near them. And I know that where women have to go to work and leave their babies at a very young age, and I know that, you know, sort of a second-hand view from what my sister had said about how upset really that a woman was at work because she was having to be there because of the money and not to be with the child. But of course, everyone isn't the same, and some people probably see, you know, sort of a more natural, if I can use the word in that context, about sort of being with small children than others. But the problem is it's having the children with shortage of money and conditions, and you've got this has been referred to, the sort of breakdown of relationships and all those kinds of pressures that and I think this sort of I don't know what would happen to schooling, but I still sort of regard this as a sort of either a conveyor belt or treadmill that very little children start off, they've got to go every day in the dark and the cold, and even take quite little ones have some kind of homework to take home. And I really think that we could do something better than that.
Yeah, I can't say that. Would go for the kind of child upbringing that Rob was suggesting might have.
Community.
I think rather than that, there might be much more of going back towards the greater family, family.
Yes.
As in today, there are so many grandparents that take a big hand in childcare and picking them up from school and all the rest of it when the parents are working. And also, I mean, to be anecdotal, it seems to be fashionable.
Why not?
I mean, my own granddaughters were looked after by the first one went to a nursery for a few till the second one was born, and then they had a nanny who came in daily, and they were excellent, absolutely wonderful. And you know, then after they were at school, I'd pick them up sometimes and so on. And they also had a bit of aftercare, after-school care, in a local organisation that used a school, which was excellent, absolutely excellent. So, you know, obviously experiences differ. But, you know, it's all about where women and, you know, parents, both parents, have to go to work to earn the money to pay the mortgage or what have you. And that is not getting any easier.
Sounds as if Kent is different from Vauxhall. Yeah. Sounds as if Kent is different from Vauxhall.
I don't live in Kent, I live in Surrey.
Oh, okay. It did worse.
There's a thought now that children are becoming commodities in the better off families, where they have to have so many trips to extra tuition for this, that and the other, because they're not doing too well in school, and if they don't do a little bit better, they won't get into the better school that the parents would like them to go to. There was also that controversy where parents were moving or giving false addresses so that the children could get into, and this is all to sort of push children on within capitalism. It isn't particularly through love of the child, I don't think. I think it's because it's a status symbol of how well their children are doing within society, within the society that they live in.
The children are stressed. They've always been stressed. Even in my day, they were stressed.
Sorry, I didn't hear.
Which old Paul?
Children are stressed, she said.
Are being stressed.
The happiest time in my life, as it happens, was when I was being cared for by two women during the war, when I was evacuated and there was my mother and an aunt in the same household, and they were organising their duties or the chores in the house. And there wasn't a pressure on just one woman to do everything and look after the children.
Yeah, I used to think the ratio of two adults to a child was pretty good.
I just remembered Vauxhall is in Surrey.
Yeah.
Vauxhall is in Surrey, isn't it?
Is it?
The Oval is the Surrey County Cricket. Any more questions anybody else want to say?
What about the thing about the commodification of women? Has feminism, as the writer of this book, Kate Barnyard, she quotes a couple of men, including Cameron, but one's Stuart Rose, the chairman of Marks and Spencer's, believes that women have reached their potential as regards fighter pilots and dentists, various other things. And David Cameron, when asked was he a feminist, wasn't too sure what it meant, says that he heard and said, I suspect probably not. But the presumption is that she thinks the society, that the feminist movement have attained the goals that, you know, they might be mixed and varied, but have attained it. Whereas she lists the number of inequalities that are collected from, she's also worked with the Fawcett Society, and she's also, I think, been one of the number of women that have been involved in the FOM, I think she mentioned earlier on, but I can't find it now. But she lists these thing about the pay in Britain being 22% less per hour than men. Women do 2/3 of the world's work, yet receive 10% of the world's income, and own 1% of the means of production. And at least 100,000 women are raped every year, with a conviction rate of 6.5%. So that might tell us something about attitudes of men. How they see women, and 18.7, which we already mentioned about members of parliament, but also prostitution, you know, the numbers of men paying for this has increased double since the 1990s, and about the idea of schools. That it wasn't until she went to university that she became discovered feminism. And prior to that, she said that there was no gender inequalities discussed in schools, talked about. So I wondered, from the point of view of maybe other inequalities like race or ethnic. So there's quite a lot there that I've read out. It's a bit late, really, but maybe you don't have to address all of them, maybe anything that you know. But the idea is about the codification. I noticed myself about young girls, maybe preteens, that dress as if like the adults that are paraded as celebrities in the mags nowadays, which is fairly, fairly prolific in most of the papers and glossy mags. So they're about this image of women. So maybe there might be a correlation between that and the 100,000 or so rapes a year. But little girls being prepared, objectified, sexualised at a very young age, you know, miniature sort of.
It's all about selling, isn't it?
Yes.
Selling goods. I mean, you said about the young girls, but I mean, the baby clothes, when I was looking for baby clothes for grandchildren, they were very hard, you know, sort of like imitation jeans and sort of very much sort of not baby clothes, but sort of adult clothes in a baby size, more of the thing. But I mean, fashion's a commodity anyway. It's produced for sale, and you've got to sort of keep sort of. And it always seems extraordinary to me what people would do in the name of fashion and of ideas that for selling that come along. I don't know, for some reason just popped into my mind the people sitting in the shop windows with their feet in a water with fish nibbling at them, you know, but fortunately they seem to have come and gone quite quickly to things. But fashion is an extraordinary thing. The other thing about the clothes, at the time when there's sort of warnings about not too much exposure to the sun and so on, it seemed to be having less cover, less protection from it. I think it can go too much the other way, because you need a certain amount of sunshine. But I mean, there's this sort of a breakdown to some extent of sort of family life, and people, it's more as individuals rather than as what Phyllis said, from the extended family and then to the nuclear family, and then sort of just sort of all as individuals. And I mean, what this the pressures on people of the need to get money in order to get the fantastic array of things that sort of potentially available, that sort of told, you know, if you want to be beautiful, if you want to, you know, if you really love your family, this is what you do, and there's all this sort of pressure. And I mean, this sort of time and sort of shift work, where people would sort of, one works at night and one works at day, and all kinds of variations on that, and sort of getting there. And children are involved in a lot more activities than they used to be, and all things that have to be bought. And I was that one of the things I thought of children's parties, you know, whereas I had a group of children and some tea and some games and so on. Now it's got to be themed activities, and going to swimming parties, or to going to different things, and all things, all activities that to be bought. I mean, the leisure industry is absolutely sort of is fantastic, and people sort of needing to be sort of busy all the time, doing things all the time. But it's all about this sort of the quest for profit. The system is based on sale and profit and expansion, and looking for new ways of doing things, which sometimes turn out to be the old ways, sort of dressed up, looking a little bit different. But it's all about the need to sort of sell things.
Yes. Well, perhaps, because you did say, you noted at the beginning that you might be a bit ferocious, because you're dealing essentially with this country and certain countries, but have you got any views or later about conditions improved or worsened in, say, India or
Saudi Arabia?
Saudi Arabia. Many of the developing countries.
I sort of felt that I should apologise to women of other countries, because I with the time that I had for this, I haven't really for this meeting sort of done anything on it. I mean, we know about Saudi women campaigning so that they are able to drive cars. There are things like the spread of education amongst women, so that even sort of poor women, and I think the example I recall is of Bangladesh, where the number of children that women are having are sort of about half what their parents were having, their other generations were having. In some places, women are involved in doing a lot of the work. I was thinking of things like this sort of, I'm having to try and drag this into mind, the improving the soil and different things that can be done in the quite poor soils to bring it back, and women sort of involved with sort of doing this. It's one of the reasons I sort of joined the party, because I of being aware of problems that there were in all different places, and I think in South Africa and things, and I sort of thought, well, there isn't really anything, I can't go on all the demonstrations, there isn't anything I can do, and because the what is wrong, if I can use that word, is the way things are organised with the minority ownership of the means of production. And it seemed to me that if I could in some way contribute to people where I actually lived, which is, you know, in this country, towards the spread of that idea, that would be the best thing I could do towards the helping sort of solve these other problems, which, and as I said, that the we're aware that the oppression of some sections is much harsher than others, and it is that sort of drives us to want to change things, as well as what's been really referred to here, that the problems that you have in the longer industrial societies that other places are rapidly catching up with, and getting the same kinds of illnesses that in places that come with that. But that seemed to me I'm sorry, I haven't got more sort of data or whatever at my fingertips this afternoon, but that is the best that I can do, is that the spread of ideas here where we are would be a big contribution to solving the problems of the poverty of the minority and the oppression by the majority, if I can put it like that.
I was just going to read something out, maybe in response to maybe someone else, to answer frankly about this forward of this book introduction about and effects of climate change, amongst other things that yeah. refers to in Bangladesh that you just mentioned there. That in the when it was hit by a cyclone, 90% of the 140,000 people killed were women, 90%. And the reason is attributed to, presumed to do the custom and dress maybe. It says here, the clothes of women wore hampered their efforts to run and swim to safety, and some were not permitted to leave their house without a male relative.
Where was this?
Bangladesh.
It strikes me that's what women should be complaining about. Islam.
It's enforced by men, isn't it?
Anyway, that sounds like you're summing up on us.
Well, if you like.
Well, I know, we can carry on for one, maybe more certainly.